Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. And when I'm not hosting In the Drink here at Heritage, you can find me where I act as beverage director and partner to our restaurants, Del Anima, L'Artusi, Lepicho, and Anfora. And for this summer only, well, maybe next year too, to be determined, we're at the Highline Hotel at Alta Linea in their absolutely beautiful courtyard, serving up frozen Negronis amongst other things. If you are a fan of In the Drink, please do subscribe to us on iTunes, or you can always listen to back episodes as well as episodes streaming live on www.heritageradionetwork.org. And thanks so much for tuning in. So today I'm really excited. I have someone who has a shared interest in vermouth, in fortified wines, except he has gone ahead and made it his career. We have Adam Ford in the house today. Adam is the founder of Adsby Vermouth and also the author of this absolutely gorgeous book called Vermouth, The Revival of the Spirit That Created America's Cocktail Culture. It is beautiful. It is the work, the official, in my opinion, work on all things vermouth. So, Adam, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you.
Thank you, Joe. This is really great to be here, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
Yeah, so I'm kind of blown away. You know, you have a full successful career as a lawyer, and you've gone ahead and created this great vermouth company, which you can find Adsby Vermouth, by the way, at Anfora and also at Alta Linea, where we have a ton of vermouth there, and also in this extremely well-researched book. How do you find the time? I feel like I am busy, but I feel like I'm not as accomplished as I should be.
Yeah, I don't really have a good answer. Efficiency, lack of sleep are two things that come to mind. I don't know how I do it. I just I found a really nice space, a really nice career. I really enjoy being a lawyer. It's just I get a lot of fulfillment from that, using that side of my brain. And then a couple of years ago, after I did this the hike, you know, the tour to Mont Blanc, where my wife and I hiked around Mont Blanc, and I discovered kind of what vermouth really could taste like when made properly with quality ingredients. It just something hit me that this was something I needed to bring back to the United States and kind of introduce people to and get them into drinking again. And in the process, I realized I was able to use kind of a completely different side of my brain to get a little bit more creative, a little bit more artistic. And I've managed to somehow merge the two. And as it turns out, I used, you know, all the skills I've kind of built from going to law school and being a lawyer, you know, first to create Adsby Vermouth. I had to teach myself how to make it, which required a ton of research. And then obviously the book is kind of filled with the well over 100 pages of research. Also, you know, completely new stuff, you know, all original source material. So
when you were on this hiking trip, you weren't drinking Martini and Rossi, right? What did you find there that we couldn't find here? And where were you, on the Swiss side of Mont Blanc, or were you on the Italian Monte Bianco side?
Yeah, we had just come into the Italian side. So you start in Courmayeur, you walk. You start
I know the answer to this, but I'm just making you work for it.
Yeah, no. So no, I'm completely blanking. So you start in the French town, Chamonix. My goodness, Chamonix. And then when you're about 9 days in, you finally get to Italy, and that's where you hit the resort town of Courmayeur, which is this really kind of idyllic Italian ski resort. This was in July. when we were there. So, you know, summertime, mm-hmm. and the answer, I'm not sure what vermouth it was. At the time, I wasn't paying attention. It was just kind of vermouth, which was kind of a new experience. And it was my wife who suggested I try it. I don't think it was Martini and Rossi. Although, as it turns out, you know, the Martini and Rossi that's being served in Italy, as I came to find out, is a different formula. So it tastes quite different. They actually just released, I don't know if it's the same exact formula, but they just put out what they call their reserve vermouth, mm-hmm. Which they just released a Tales of the Cocktail, and it's now in the United States. And it's a much higher quality, it's actually quite good, vermouth that they're now sending to America for the first time.
Wow. And so is this hike, this is a thing that people do, or is this something that you, is this kind of like a well-established hiking route that... It's kind of a bucket list sort of thing, or is this just you guys designed it yourselves?
No. Yeah, no. It's called the Tour du Mont Blanc. Okay. It's actually referred to, and they call it the nicest walk in Europe. So it's a well-plotted trail. I don't know the numbers. Thousands of people do it every year. And what's so fantastic about it is, unlike hiking in the United States, where a lot of times you're in the woods, you got to carry your own tent, maybe you have a lean-to. There in Europe, there's just this nice sophistication. They've got these little, you know, kind of huts and restaurants all along the way. You literally don't need to carry anything more than just your backpack and a bottle of water and maybe some trail mix or something, because for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you're at these really nice, not nice, but just, you know, little kind of huts, but cooking really nice food all along the way. And then you sleep and, you know, some of them are, you know, kind of bunks where you're just kind of on top of strangers.
Wow. So you get back and you're like, honey, I want to, on top of being a lawyer and I'm sure working more hours than anyone else, you know, you want to start this new business. And what was that conversation? When did that kind of realization happen?
It was a couple of years later. You know, I mean, it was kind of in my mind, but it's not that I just kind of got back to the United States. I have to do this. It was one of those things where I get back to the United States, I go back to work. We had a wonderful trip, a wonderful time. You know, I had a wonderful experience that night. And it's as I start to kind of look around and see that Americans are getting really into craft spirits. Mm-hmm. You know, Tuttletown by this time had come out and really made a mark. There's all these craft spirits going out. The cocktail movement's going on. The craft beer is getting cool. And I'm realizing that nobody has improved vermouth. No one had done a craft vermouth. And once I started thinking about it, how important vermouth is to all of these cocktails, all the classic cocktails, it struck me as really strange. And that kind of put me on the path of, wait a second, why don't I try and do a craft vermouth? Why don't I try and, you know, bring that ethos of the craft?
I can think of even 7-8 years ago when we opened Del Anima, when Carpano Antica formula, I think, had just come to the market and it was in short supply.
Yeah.
And people were very, very, very excited about it because that was really the only premium vermouth that we had at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's interesting that you even mention knowing about Antica formula, because it was in 7-8 years ago, it was very limited supply. When I first did my business plan for Atsby, which I think I first started drafting in around 2010, I thought there was like Martini and Rossi, Cinzano, and Noilly Pratt. I mean, Dolin hadn't yet come into the market. Carpano, I think, was around, but it wasn't, very few people knew about it, right? It just didn't seem to be, it just wasn't there. So it was, you know.
Yeah, I think it was my first time buying spirits or wine, really. But so I was looking through all of the price books and trying to research like what were Italian products that we could put into this Italian-ish restaurant that is Del Anima.
Yeah.
And I just kind of came across it, and it was great, and the packaging was beautiful, and it's like, this is fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great product. It is, and the Carpano company deserves a lot of credit for getting people into vermouth. It really was kind of the first, you know, really high quality kind of delicious vermouths that Americans have been exposed to.
Yeah, one of the cool things I love about your book is really the amount of history that you put into it. And you know, we talk about Carpano as creating vermouth and this Antica formula as maybe being the original formula, maybe not. But you say in the book that there's actually this really long history, millennia of people drinking fortified and aromatized wine well before Carpano invented it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah, this was the history, like I said, I was also, by the way, a history major at the University of Pittsburgh, so I really loved kind of getting into it. And it's fascinating to kind of discover that humans have been putting herbs and spices and roots and barks in their fermented beverages, fermented berries, and then including grapes as well. Going back, you know, almost 8,000, 9,000, 10,000 years are some of the earliest samples. It's happening everywhere. It's happening in China. It's happening in Persia, in India, in South America, not in North America, interestingly, but all over the world. And frankly, for several, I think, thousand years, independent. So there's kind of these, it's not as though the idea of aromatized wine starts in one place and then travels around. People independently are figuring this out. That part of the story is fascinating. And then even just the very rich history of aromatized wines, which I refer to as vermouth's kind of closest cousins, you know, during the Roman Empire, there's something called Mulsum and Conditum, something called Hippocras, all of which were based on this idea of taking an aromatized wine, aromatizing it with different herbs and spices from around the world, some local, some from around the world. And then sweetening it, and then the, you know, the fortification winds up coming up, I think, in the 15th century.
And the fortification is a more when wines were being shipped on boats, right, and to keep it stronger and prevent oxidation.
That's exactly right. Yeah, people figured that out. Yeah,
that's pretty smart. And what is the introduction of wormwood that actually makes makes vermouth, as we know today, to have some portion of wormwood into it?
Well, it's an interesting question. It's kind of like the wormwood question, right? This is the thing
that's the big one.
The answer
is because wormwood is, I think, now today a controlled substance, right?
Oh yeah, it's been right. It was banned in I think 1910 or the early 1900s. So the story that everyone was talking about, you know, do you need wormwood to make vermouth? This is kind of the big debate. And when I was studying vermouth and figuring out how to make it, just nobody was talking about wormwood because there was, you know, it's just nobody was talking about it. And my understanding of it was a bit of a relic. It was something that at one point was added, but certainly hadn't been used for well over 100 years. So when I made my vermouths, I didn't use wormwood. I frankly tasted it. I found it overly bitter, and I found the only way to contrast that bitter was to add too much sugar. And I wanted vermouths that weren't overly sweet and overly bitter. So I left it out, and I didn't realize that it was going to start this big debate, started by the European producers. I think it was a bit of just a public relations ploy, really, because when you look at the history of vermouth, you know, wormwood certainly plays a role, but it's not quite as instrumental as I think a lot of people have been writing. And certainly nowadays, and certainly for the past 100-110 years, the amount of wormwood, if used at all, has been so minuscule you can't even taste it. A lot of people now are trying to go back and say, oh, we use wormwood. But even if you're using wormwood today, you have to strip it of its chemical component, which is called thujone. You're only allowed to use 10 parts per million thujone in vermouth or any beverage, absinthe, which is why absinthe producers don't really use wormwood anymore. They use anise and fennel. So the thing with the wormwood is that even if you're using it, you're stripping it of mm-hmm. its active chemical component. So it's a bit of a eunuch at that point. So a lot of people get excited that they're saying that we use wormwood. And it's like, oh, okay, but you're not using any thujone. So all you're kind of doing is saying, you know, we're putting in a little bit of the spice, not too much flavor. It doesn't even give you much, you know. You're relying, because even if, you know, if you make a good vermouth, you know, you're using dozens of botanicals. Wormwood is just a very small part, like
having a layover at the Rome airport, never leaving the airport and saying you went to Italy, almost.
I think that's right. Yeah.
It's just stepping into it a little bit, but you really didn't get anything out of it.
I think that's exactly right. That's certainly my take on it. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if you find that this big publicity stunt from the European producers who got so riled up about, maybe it was beneficial to everyone. They got the press, and you got the press, and people defended strongly in either way.
I think
the conversation.
It's hard to see. Yeah, that very well might be it. I mean, the whole look. The answer is I don't know, right? I mean, it's interesting. Vermouth is very popular now. It's really kind of trending. Thankfully, there's been a lot of excitement about the book. It's been selling. People are kind of getting into the topic. And I think, you know, look, the debate may have played into it. At the same time, you know, I've sat around a lot of conferences hearing representatives from some of the big brands talking about how American vermouth producers should not be able to call their products vermouth. Which is just kind of preposterous. So maybe it's been good, but certainly frustrating along the way.
Have you been able to get your hands on enough Dujon to cause damage to have some fun with it?
I have it. I mean, I've tried a lot of different wormwoods. I've drank a lot of. Actually, as it turns out, and here's the thing with Dujon, you do have to get it really high to do any sort of neurological damage. I don't even know. You'd really have to. It'd be intentional. But there's actually more Thujon, as it turns out, in sage than there is in wormwood.
Interesting.
By leaps and bounds. I do use sage in both my vermouths. But interestingly, if you use sage, you actually don't have to get it tested, or nobody cares. So I haven't had my vermouths tasted. I don't know how much Thujon in. But I do use sage, and so it's very possible. That the Thujon content is actually higher in Atsby than it is in Martini and Rossi. So by way of, you know, Martini and Rossi, their Thujon level is zero, absolutely zero.
So they've treated it and stripped it out.
They've completely stripped it. Yeah, a lot of producers, you'll find trace amounts.
Yeah.
They're a bigger company. I think they're able to treat it. They really know what they're doing. And so there's zero Thujon in the Martini and Rossi.
Wow. So drink Atsby vermouth and get your daily requirement of Thujon. On that note, we are going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of Adam Ford, the founder of Atsby Vermouth and the author of Vermouth, the revival of the spirit that created America's cocktail culture, in just a minute.
Take a sip from your chalice just and I.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels to lower barrel entry proof before heat-cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said, it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's, phenomenal. For more information, visit Michter's.com or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, and we are back on In the Drink. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and we are in the studio today with Adam Ford, the founder of Atsby Vermouth and author of the seminal book on vermouth. In the kind of subtext of the title, it says, "The Revival of the Spirit that Created America's Cocktail Culture." We spoke a little bit about how vermouth less than a decade ago was... The options were very, very few, and now there are many. But I'd really like to, for a minute, focus on this idea of the spirit that created America's cocktail culture, and how and when did that happen?
Yeah, that's a great question. This chapter was far and away my favorite chapter to write. As it turns out, most of the action takes place in New York City. Why I gave it that subtitle is because that's really what I focus on in this book. There's a lot of story. I mean, vermouth has a 10,000-year-old history. I say right from the beginning, I'm not covering it all in this book. I'm going to try and do as much as I can here, but there's lots more to be researched and written. But what I really did focus on was vermouth's role in cocktail culture. And it's, you know, David Wondrich, the, you know, world's foremost cocktail historian, has referred to vermouth as the wonder ingredient. And I think he was dead on in that description, because what happened, it's cocktails really start getting created, really take off, once vermouth gets to U.S. shores, and particularly in New York City in the 1860s, 1870s, and then 1880s is when it's really taking off. But, you know, the country's best bartenders, you know, Harry Johnson, Jerry Thomas, the only William, all these guys that have been canonized recently, all of their cocktail books being recently republished and flying off the shelves, they were all bartending along a small stretch on Broadway, frankly, between Houston and Prince Street, what's now Soho. The best designation you could earn was a Broadway bartender. And what happens is these guys, once vermouth gets here, all of a sudden cocktails move from, you know, being kind of, you know, sugar, bitters, and spirit into all of these wild different flavors and concoctions. You know, the Manhattan is created there by a man named Black in the 1860s. The Manhattan, by the way, and the martini, the original recipes call for 2 ounces of vermouth and 1 ounce of spirit. And if you look, if you go through all of these cocktail books, you'll see vermouth treated as any other spirit, with the exception of its importance and prominence. And by the time you get to the old Waldorf bar book in 1936, right before World War II, over half of every cocktail created includes vermouth as either a primary or essential ingredient in the cocktail. So I argue, I think persuasively, that it's really vermouth, more than any other spirit, that's responsible for the sort of cocktail culture as we know it in the United States.
So it's really in that like 1850s period where you went from... in the late 18th century, people drinking just straight spirits or punches, to early 19th century, people kind of having these spirit, bitter, sugar cocktails, to now mid-19th century, people are introducing imported ingredients like vermouth, and that's what's really taken to the next level.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this is coinciding, by the way, at a time in U.S. history, and certainly New York City history, of this is when the robber barons are coming out. People are starting to get very wealthy. But there's also a middle class that's appearing during this time period, during the late 19th century. And this new middle class all of a sudden has some extra money to start thinking about how they want to spend. They start buying nicer clothes. They start buying things for the home. And they also want different things to drink. So they're no longer satisfied just going to a beer hall, right, or just going to some other, you know, kind of gaslight basement dive, having straight whiskey or straight brandy or something like that. They want something kind of a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more elegant, a little bit more drinkable. So this is all kind of happening at the same time. Yeah, and so that's kind of the backstory. And then obviously, the book's title is The Revival of the Spirit, because as we know, after World War II, vermouth goes from being, you know, one of the most kind of sophisticated, coolest things to be drinking, to something that just, it completely falls off the map, right? And there's very good and interesting historical reasons for that. Mostly during World War II, all of the producers were in Italy and France. The United States had extremely bad tax laws. There was a quadruple tax on vermouth production, which made it prohibitively expensive for U.S. producers to make it. And so during World War II, all the French producers and Italian producers get cut off. And then there's also extremely anti-French and Italian sentiment going on. So people don't want to touch this stuff. It never really recovers, afterwards. And then what's really interesting is people start using less and less vermouth in their martinis in the Manhattans. And the response of the European producers is to reformulate their vermouths from these beautiful aperitif wines that could be drank on their own into something made for mixing, which is why you have now generations of people that don't know what vermouth is, think of it only as a modifier or a mixer, right? And that's why, and then it really falls off the map, because then it's like, well, we didn't really want to use that much any of it, and now the stuff that's coming over is kind of disgusting. Mm-hmm. And that takes us all the way up to, you know, frankly, 2010, 2011, excluding the 1999, where Andrew Quaddy puts out a very nice vermouth called Vaya. But that's, a bit of a novelty for about a decade until these past few years.
And was there any one thing that you could say happened, or is it a bunch of events that happened together that have created this environment for people to go out and produce a bunch of vermouths?
That's a great question.
So it happened in such a short period of time.
It does, and it happened, and it's, like I said, I mean, as I said earlier, it was, I think, there is this craft, there's this craft and classic cocktail movement going on. There's a craft spirits going on. Carl Sutton shows up in 2010 and decides he wants to make kind of a really high quality Californian vermouth, right? Neil Coplin up in Portland, Oregon, the very next year. And Neil had known about Carl during that time, and they talked a little bit, and then they put out a vermouth. And then, meanwhile, I'm over on the East Coast. I actually didn't even know about Neil or Carl when I first started. As I got closer, I caught wind of them, but they were still very small and very local. And then, as it turns out, Bianca Moralia over in Brooklyn was working on her vermouth at the same time. And I think what we all realized independently was that vermouth really is this really amazing category of drink that could be delicious. People really could get into. We just didn't have access to it. And I think this coincided at a time where Americans were getting really into new and interesting flavors, such as the bitters. Obviously, there was a huge bitter boom. I think people were moving away from the sort of overly sweet, kind of silly cocktails of the Sex and the City age, the Cosmopolitan, and that sort of the Appletini sort of nonsense. So again, I think there's kind of a confluence of events that leads to, and then, by the way, actually, just to say on, so then you have, and then Patrick Taylor, whose vermouth we're going to try in just a second, his Hammer and Tongs vermouth comes out. And then what happens is then you start getting the bigger European producers and other bigger companies realizing, wait a second, we need to start re-releasing, or making, higher quality vermouths as well, which, as I mentioned earlier, it's fascinating that, Hatsby vermouth, we launched a reserve vermouth, which is aged just about 3 years ago, over a year ago. And then just a couple months ago, Martini & Rossi releases its reserve vermouth this year. So there's a lot of pieces going on, and people are playing off of each other, and the U.S. producers are making high-quality stuff, and the bigger producers are picking up and saying, all right, we got to start making better stuff. And as the quality improves, people are going to start drinking it more, which is what we've seen.
I hope you're right. It's something that I've loved for a while. We have it on our list. We have an extensive amount on our list at Alta Linea. But people have not quite embraced it the way that I've hoped, and I just love it. I just love it. It's something that I always have, and we treat it the right. We have it all in the refrigerated, which
Great.
I think is very important.
Of course, yeah.
Especially Alta Linea is an outdoor, so in the summer, and it's something that I drink at home. I have a half bottle, if possible, of vermouth in the refrigerator at all times. So I always find it stays fresher that way.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you definitely want to treat it like a wine. I'll bring, I get some argon, some gas or something to spray it in, or if you can use even, what do they call those suck pumps for wine that suck out all the oxygen. But yeah, you really want, that's really how you preserve.
That makes so much sense. We actually have those at Alta Linea, and I don't use it for the mousse, but we are going to start doing that as of tonight.
Fantastic.
Yeah, those pumps are fantastic. So you've actually brought some vermouth with you.
I have.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love on-air tastings. I like off-air tastings too. Actually, so today I brought three different vermouths that I think really represent some of these new styles of vermouth coming out. The first one we're going to taste is Uncouth Vermouth made by Bianca Moralia out in Red Hook, Brooklyn. Bianca makes really fantastic, interesting vermouths, and when I say interesting, really, really different than kind of your traditional sweeter dry styles. And I see that you're tasting it. What do you think? I could talk about it, but what do you, having just tasted it?
It looks like cider. Has like an unfiltered kind of quality to it. It's a little cloudy, kind of like some of the orange wines that I like. And it actually is very vinous. It tastes very much like wine, and it has kind of a cidery note to it as well. My mouth is watering. Lots of acidity.
Yep. Yeah, you're picking up exactly on what Bianca does and what a lot of the new producers are doing, which was to leave in the wine quality, to remind people that vermouths really are aromatized wines. They're not just modifiers. They're not just flavoring agents. Her vermouths are unfiltered, and they are they include dozens of different botanicals. All of Bianca's are hand foraged, and locally sourced. Bianca's amazing. She'll just head out in her hatchback to her secret spots in the woods and pick wild herbs. Wow. one of which is mugwort, which is in the Artemisia family. So that's also in the same family as wormwood. She used that. This is called her rhubarb vermouth, and she uses little rhubarb
as well. It's incredibly complex. Every time I go back, I'm getting like a lot of like white tea notes to it right now. Awesome. It's completely dry, I think, right? Or very dry at least, but without being, if you were to have a less good quality dry white vermouth, it's hard to sip it on its own.
That's exactly
it. This is very sippable.
Yeah, these are all three of these vermouths that I brought today are made to be drank on their own, which again is the way vermouths would have been made for a very long time.
Now, what's your thought about sipping vermouth with, do you like it kind of just chilled and straight? Do you like it with rocks? Do you put a peel? Or I know in France, sometimes they actually put pieces of fruit in there because they're like, peel's already in it. We want the actual fruit.
We want the fruit. Yeah, it depends on the vermouth. Mm-hmm. A lot of the sort of the newer vermouth, certainly on Couths and Patrick Taylor's, the Hammer and Tongs, and the Imbue vermouths. I actually like just chilled without ice. If I'm drinking, one of the more classical style vermouths, maybe the Punta Mace or even the Carpano Antica, those I find to be a little syrupy to be drinking straight, and so I'll add some ice cubes just to dilute it a little bit. So it really depends on the vermouth, but certainly, if I had to say, I think just chilled, no ice in a wine glass is really the way to do it. So what you're about to taste now, this is the second one. This is my reserve vermouth. This is the Armadillo Cake, which has a base of a vintage Chardonnay, 32 different botanicals, sweetened with caramel from dark Indian Muscovado sugar, fortified with apple brandy. And then what's really cool about it is we let it age for about 3 years, which is really special. The bottle actually says 2 years because we came in just under three. I wanted to bottle it, so I put two on the label. But it's just about 3 years in stainless steel tanks. And this one is totally different than just the regular Armadillo Cake in that it's mellowed. What do you think of that one?
Oh, I think this is awesome. This is more gulpable, I would say. it's more easy to love, more golden retriever like.
Yeah.
It's going back and forth. It reminds me in a way of a really good beer. I don't know what's in it. And then I'm also getting some like woody herbs like rosemary, and I keep going back and forth to those, like, oh, is it more like good beer like, is it more rosemary like. I'm interested about your use of a Chardonnay. I would tell people Chardonnay is a neutral grape and be like, no, Chardonnay is very flavorful. But what's your idea about using Chardonnay as the base spirit or base wine for this?
Yeah, so I tried, I mean, you know, I knew I wanted to use a local wine, a New York wine. We were making New York vermouth, and I tried, you know, wines from all over our state. I wound up, you know, landing on gravitating towards the North Fork wines, and with the North Fork Chardonnay, I found it, frankly, to have, a fairly neutral profile, but with really nice saline salinity to it, right, from being near the ocean. I found it to be highly acidic, which I thought was really kind of nice. And then just the sort of the subtle undertones. There were some pears in there, and just some really kind of subtle flavors that I thought just worked really well with the botanicals that I was picking.
That's delicious. There are no hops in here at all?
No hops. Yeah, the other.
It's like that floral kind of green florally note. That's,
yeah. Other people actually, it's funny. A lot of people say that. A lot of people mention the beer comment. They say, "Oh, this kind of tastes like a beer." I'm not. I don't know what it is. You know, there's 32 different spices and roots and pods. And what winds up happening, especially after the 3 years, is that all of these chemical components break down and interlace again. And so there's all these new flavors in there. If you're tasting hops, it's because chemical components from 9 different things came together and formed something that's
like a malty,
just like hops.
Malty. It's so good. That's crazy.
And then the third one is this is called Hammer and Tongs. This is made by Patrick Taylor out in Portland, Oregon. Patrick's fantastic. This one's called La Freak. This one's interesting. It's actually made with a red wine.
Because most red vermouths are made with white wine with lots of caramel color, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Pretty much, yeah. Vermouth really is usually a white wine base, so this makes it really interesting. And then he uses some really interesting herbs from Africa, and as you'll taste it, you'll see the difference in this one.
Does he use a Cabernet Franc base? He does. Okay, because it's really.
What you get. Yeah,
an herbaceous note, and I was wondering if that was from the herbs or is that from just like that kind of herby grape?
Yeah, you certainly get it on the nose. Mm-hmm. That's where I get it the most. And then the flavoring, it's hard to tell if that's his herbs or his wine. He just does a really nice job with blending.
It's really integrated. It doesn't seem like it's separate. It seems like it's all part of the same thing.
Everything's put together, yeah. There's all different ways to make vermouth. I don't want to say there's a right way or a wrong way, because some of the vermouths can be a little more disjointed, but they're still kind of interesting in the way that they'll kind of march down your tongue, and that's kind of cool, too. But Patrick does a nice job of integrating everything.
How would you even use this as a sipping at the end of a meal? How do you use something like this?
Well, for this one, I think the La Freak would be fantastic at the end of a meal. I use it. I think it works really well in Negronis. Not to get into sort of the mixing straight versus cocktails, but...
And you have great cocktail recipes in your book as well, so...
Thank you. Yeah, there's over 40 cocktails. A good group of them are made by some really fantastic bartenders from around the country. Charles Jolie, who just left the Avery recently, and Pam Witznitzer, who just opened Seamstress, which is doing extremely well. It's got Josh Sontag, who's at the Ace Hotel, the Breslin Lobby Bar.
And one of my favorites, Amoria Margo's Southern Tea. If you're listening, please come on the show. We have to reach out to him.
Has Southern not come on your show yet?
Not yet.
That's an easy ask.
I love that bar. I love that bar.
Yeah, it's actually my favorite bar as well in the city, certainly one of them. And if you notice, a lot of the photos in the book were actually taken at Amoria Margo.
Stunning. The photographs are beautiful. They're sexy. The book is awesome. Adam Ford, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show.
This has been great, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Guys, make sure you pick up Vermouth, The Revival of the Spirit That Created America's Cocktail Culture. It is required reading if you're into cocktails or vermouth. This is such a fantastic book, and it's absolutely beautiful. It will look great on your bookshelf. Thank you so much to everyone for listening. I also want to give a big shout out to producer Jory and technician Liz. You guys are awesome. Thank you for making sure this show happens every week. Thanks to our sponsor, Michter's, really great in the Manhattan with some vermouth. And we'll see you next week, 10 o'clock on heritageradionetwork.org. This has been In the Drink.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.